and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we have a great mystery writer. He's pretty new to the scene. This is his second book called The Hanging Tree, which is just out from Touchstone, which is a division of Simon & Schuster. Hello.
Hi, David.
How are you?
Good. Great.
As I was telling you on the phone, I really enjoy your books. I'm into Starvation Lake right now. It's the first one, and it's just really, I mean, I almost stayed up all night the other night reading this thing. It's going to drive me crazy.
Sorry about that.
No,
I'm not. But
you shouldn't be sorry, because it's...
I appreciate that. Thank
you. It means you're writing really well. You have a very unusual writing style.
Really?
Yeah, I think so.
How so?
Different from a lot of other mystery... Whether this is a mystery or thrill, whatever you want to call it, I think of it as a mystery. Of course, it says mystery right on it, so I guess I should say it's a mystery. But
my publisher will appreciate that.
You have there's something you do that really interests me. You'll start out a paragraph and you'll make this statement, and then the reader will say, well, I don't understand. And then as the paragraph goes on, you start to understand what that statement meant.
Huh.
And I really like the way you do that. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I'd have to go look, and I will when we're done.
Like, you'll say something totally out of the blue, and then you'll explain what it is and the little background. And you have a lot of flashback scenes, which usually to me are very boring, are fascinating in your books.
Thank you.
I can't stand flashback scenes. I mean, when I see them in movies, I get really annoyed.
I'd like to talk about flashbacks because it's a point of contention with some readers. But what the first thing you just said about me making a statement and then, for lack of a better word, explaining it. I'd never thought of this before. It's certainly not a conscious thing, but it may be subconscious that I do it because as a news writer, you do that all the time. You have what my 8th grade or 12th grade English teacher would have called a topic sentence. And so you assert something in the lead of a story, and then you show why it's true. Then don't do this consciously, but I'm sure this will ruin the third book it's writing for me because I'll be totally conscious of this right from the start now, David. Thank you.
No, you won't. That's not true. I don't believe that for a second. I really don't.
Thank you. It's a really interesting insight. I'm going to go look at the hanging tree later on and see. I'm sure it's there.
Well, I think what an example is you'll say something about a character, you'll say something about something that happened, and then I'll think, well, I don't know what that means. And then as the paragraph goes on, we start to understand. I think you understand a little bit what I'm trying to say.
But I get it. But it's kind of fun that way, isn't it? Isn't that what
books do? Absolutely. It's definitely.
Books do, you know, Holden Caulfield's
different.
Insane asylum. Well, what? Why?
I mean, there are
by the end of the book, you know.
Right. There are mystery writers that I read that I'll read, and everything is like so, this person did this, this person did that. I mean, after a while, it gets boring. But yours don't get that way. Yours are very interesting because your characters are very three-dimensional. You never know what they're going to do, or who they're going to blow up at. Who's going to hit who with a hockey stick,
Yeah, well, that's always unpredictable.
When did you start loving hockey so much? You obviously, I mean, from reading these books, we can tell you're a fanatic about hockey.
I've been playing since I was a kid. My dad built us a rink in the backyard a couple of winters, and there was a rink next door at the Pearsons, and then one down the street at the park, and then one at the St. Paul Retreat House near my grade school. And then I got into organized hockey and played all over and played high school, and that was really the highest organized level I played. I played men's leagues for years.
Well, you're obviously in love with the sport because it
shows. I think I'm more in love with it now than when I was a kid.
Because these books have a lot to do, and there's a lot of hockey in these books, and it's fascinating. I mean, when's the last mystery you read that had hockey in it? I don't think there's any.
I haven't read any. A few of my friends have recommended Jack Falla, F-A-L-L-A, his books.
I never even heard of him.
He's a supposedly amazing hockey novelist. He died a year or so ago, and the New York Times wrote a terrific remembrance, which I read enviously. Read some of his phrases about hockey.
Doesn't it feel good to know that even after you're gone, your books are going to be read by other people? I mean, that's got to be a good feeling.
I'd rather not think about when I'm gone, but...
Well, we wouldn't either, but I don't know why that just came in my
mind. Cool. I hope that's true. It amazes me. I mean, last year when Starvation Lake came out, and, I get sales figures, they go up and down. And I remember one week I said to my wife, I go, you know, 700, I sold 700 Starvation Lakes last week. Now that's, you know, a tiny, tiny fraction of what James Patterson or John Grisham or Stephanie Meyer sells. But then I was thinking about it, I'm like, 700 people I don't know bought my book. I'm like, that's just unbelievable.
Because it's
you're playing this bottle off the edge of a beach, and 700 people looked at it. It's cool.
Do you think you're a really good writer?
I think I'm good, yeah.
I think you're good, too.
Well, thanks. But, you know, a friend of mine said to me many, many years ago, you really have to have some degree of self-importance to write for other people, because you have to think you have something to say and that you can say it well.
Well, so, if you don't have that confidence, how are you going to write well?
Right, exactly. So, yes, I think I'm good. Am I better than that guy or that woman? I don't know. I just do my best. That's all I can do. And
well,
I hope I get better. You know, most things in life, you do them over and over, you get better, except golf. But.
Golf. I don't think golf would make a good thing in a mystery series. I mean, what would you do? I mean, somebody had to get killed on the links or something. But even then, it would be kind of, I don't know. I'm sure somebody has done it.
I know so little about it, I won't be writing any golf.
But the question is, how did you get Harlan Coben to say such wonderful things about you?
It's only like $500, I think I had to send him.
$500?
I'm kidding. you know, it's a funny story. A friend of a friend knew Harlan, and he responded, and I have since met him a couple of times, and he's really a very nice guy.
That's terrific, man.
Regular, normal guy, like a lot of the people in this genre, at least. Really great people.
Now, you told me when we were talking earlier that you really don't read a lot of mysteries and thrillers, so why do you write something you don't read?
Well, I mean
let's see.
I read.
You didn't think these questions were going to be easy, did you?
No. I mean, I read widely when I can read.
Why can't you read? You mean because you're writing?
Well, I work all day, and I write in the mornings, and I get home at night, and then I got to finish reading newspapers, and, you know, then I'm reading. And right now I'm reading a mystery, actually, Winter's Keep, or Heaven's Keep, by William Kent Kruger.
Yes.
It's really nice, really well done, and I'm going to be on a panel with Kent next month.
He's terrific.
A very nice man. I've met him a couple times. But I didn't really read mysteries. I mean, I read Hammett. I read Chandler. I read Mike Connelly. Love Thomas Harris's first. I love Red Dragon. I just love that book. And not something I would ever write. But don't you
think we're all capable of writing that well? Or do you think it's only certain people that could write that well?
It's like anything, you know. Some people have some germ of a skill, and they develop it. And some people just don't have that. They have other, you know, they have other gifts. But I didn't really read a lot of those kinds of books. And when I set out to write Starvation Lake in 2002, I just had a germ of an idea. I knew the beginning, and I knew the end, and I knew the setting, and I started writing. And it wasn't until, I started getting rejection letters that I understood that I hadn't written quite what they wanted in the mystery genre. And on the other hand, it wasn't considered literary fiction. And so I was stuck. That's why I got 26 rejections.
26? That's a lot.
Yeah, you know, from what I've heard, it is, you know, it's not as many as, say, The Lovely Bones, I heard, got like 40-some.
And look where that is now.
Yeah, there's 40 editors out there going, that was a fish that got away. But
did you change something after that, after those rejections, or did
nothing
at all?
Well, after 19, I changed the ending at my a little bit at my agent's request, but that's not going to matter because I don't believe most of those rejections read the whole book.
Why would they reject something? It's obviously, there's some major talent here. I mean,
that's nice of you to say, but
I feel that way.
A lot of that's nice, but thank you. It's not genuinely. I thank you, but a lot of it has to do, at least from my reading of the letters, with where do we put this? How do we sell it? And the letters were almost uniformly Brian Grilley is a good writer, he has great characters, this is a wonderful setting, and we know that you'll find a good home for this, but not here.
That seems so, I don't know.
Being an editor, you can't say yes to everything.
No.
You just can't. So you got to say no to some things, and sometimes you say no to the wrong things. And then I've told reporters, nah, that's no good of a story, and then it ends up in the New York Times 2 months later, and I look like a schmuck, I made the wrong call. Everybody makes the wrong call.
It seems so closed-minded of these publishers, but I guess there has to be, like you said, there has to be a limit somewhere.
I'm sure they all did it in good faith, and that's the way it goes. And luckily for me, the one who did want it, and it only takes one, I would say to all those aspiring writers out there, just one, said, I want 3 books.
Wow.
Starvation Lake. That wasn't my plan. I just wrote one. People say, so you're writing the third book in the trilogy. Well, the trilogy gives it a much nicer sheen than it deserves because I just had one book planned. I'm not George Lucas planning.
Well, I don't want it to end after three. Don't tell me it's going to end after three. That would really upset me.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I have a 3-book deal, and then we'll see what happens.
But you have, obviously, you can go longer than 3 books. I can tell by the second book. I mean,
I can, but right now I'm mainly worried about the next chapter in book 3.
Well, you were the number one indie pick for this Hanging Tree. That's amazing. The number one of any book out there. I mean, think about that. That's pretty amazing.
I have some nice friends out there in the indie bookseller world. Yeah, they're nice people.
Yeah, but when I first saw that, I thought, wow, now I really have to read this series. So I went and read that. The Hanging Tree. Now I'm reading the Starvation Lake, and it's just terrific. And the characters really grow on you. And Gus gets treated very badly in these books.
Yeah.
I mean, overall, they're pretty lousy the way they treat him.
Well, you'll learn more in Starvation Lake about his past. He did something that made everybody in town mad, and then when he was just a kid, and then years later, he finds other ways to do things that make them mad. But I think Gus grows up a little faster than the town does.
Now, how old is Gus at the beginning of Starvation Lake? I don't know if you even mentioned that.
Well, in The Hanging Tree, he's 35, I believe. So he's 34.
So each book, he'll progress a year, maybe.
Yeah.
Depending on how fast you want him to progress, I guess.
So for a single male in his mid-30s, it's about 20 minutes.
It seems like Gus sort of has confidence, but sort of doesn't. He sort of reminds me of one of these people who they can do things. They're very, very, he's very skilled at being a reporter, but he keeps getting pushed down. He keeps getting held back by these people around him who don't seem to want him to be creative.
Well, part of that is a reflection of the financial and realities of the newspaper business.
What a horrible place that's in right now.
Yeah. Well, certainly now. But, of course, these books are in 98 and 99. And depending on where you were and what time of year it was, you could face similar pressures. And Gus certainly faces them in these two books.
So there's a danger that Gus may lose his job at some point in this series.
Yeah. Well, in The Hanging Tree, he certainly faces that danger.
But I was thinking about it when I read it. I said, "What if he does lose his job? What's he going to do?" I mean, you still write a series around him, even if he didn't have a reporting job?
I guess I'd have to, or he could, start his own website.
Yeah,
DocCarpenter.com.
Start his own newspaper, but that would be very hard, I would think.
That's hard.
I just got word today that our major newspaper around here is getting rid of their TV listings, which surprised me.
Well, you're lucky that they lasted this long. Many, many newspapers threw out TV listings 2 or 3 years ago. So.
Now, are you still a newspaper reporter today?
Well, I run the Chicago Bureau for the Wall Street Journal, which means I have 10 reporters and a deputy who work for me, and we work together to cover a number of industries as well as the great Midwest. And mostly I help them figure out what stories they should do or not do, and
just like Gus.
Yeah, and help edit them and get them to the people in New York. But occasionally I write stories for the Journal, and in the past I wrote hundreds of stories for the Journal, and before that the Detroit News, and before that the Kalamazoo Gazette,
So what's more fun, writing books or working for the Wall Street Journal?
Well, I really love the book writing. And I miss, as a bureau chief, the going out there and writing stories. The most fun about journalism is going out there. You know, getting out of the office and going someplace. And
is it really as dangerous as some of these books portray it?
Well, what I've done over my career, no. But if you're in Iraq or Afghanistan, yes, very dangerous. Very dangerous. And those, you know.
But as a general rule, it's not that dangerous. It's not a job where you're going to.
You know, it depends on what you cover. But, you know, 95% of reporters, you know, they don't face any life-threatening circumstances. But those others who do, I wish the people who criticize the media for this or that, see if Rush Limbaugh or his counterpart on the left there, Keith Olbermann, would, you know, just sat down in the middle of Baghdad in the middle of a war. I don't think so.
I love your covers, the red cover and then the purplish cover on Starvation Link. They're very, very dark, and there's a lot of trees in your covers. What's up with the trees?
Well, you'd have to ask my art people. I mean, in the first book, they picked this. I love the cover of the first book, especially of Starvation Lake. It's a photograph of a lake in Romania, taken through a tree or a bush or something. And of course, then I forced their hand because the second book is based around a tree that's filled with shoes, and so they had to use a tree again.
Do any of your situations in these two books, did any of them actually happen or anything similar to happen? It seems like there's some kind of true stuff in these books, something that you might have gotten and you might have heard about. Or
Starvation Lake, the first book.
And there really is a Starvation Lake, by the way.
Yes. To answer your first question, David, in Starvation Lake there are a couple of things that happened in a different way in the real world that inspired things in the book. In The Hanging Tree, there is in fact a tree filled with shoes near the lake house that my parents bought in northern lower Michigan almost 40 years ago.
To this day it still has the shoes.
Yeah, in fact there was a little controversy over the shoe tree recently, and the transportation department there compromised and instead of chopping it down, trimmed it, took some branches off, which removed a lot of the shoes. But it's still there. And I've driven by it many, many times, and it sort of gives me the creeps. Now, once I tried to do a story about it for the Journal and made a lot of calls to Kalkaska, Michigan, the town it's near, but I could never get a bead on why they were there. The reasons were too diffuse for me to write a story. So it just stayed in the back of my mind. And when I finished Starvation Lake, I set out to write a sequel using the tree. And then I wrote a book that took me a year and a half, and eventually I had to throw it away and start over because it was bad.
Yeah, that must be horrible to have to do that, to start over again. I mean, or is it? Is it very?
It was painful. I turned it in February of 2009. Just a few weeks before the launch of Starvation Lake, which, you know, was a really exciting time in my life. I've wanted to be a novelist since I was a boy. So here I am at the age of, then I was 51. I'm going to publish my first novel and go sign books and see old friends and make new friends. In the meantime, I turn in this book and I knew it was lousy. It was too much plot and not enough story.
Mm-hmm.
Not enough character, not enough heart, not enough hockey. At least the hockey culture. And my editor called me on my second day of my tour. I was in Michigan and I had stopped somewhere to go through my email, and she called me and she said, you know, we have a lot of work to do. And so she agreed that it was lousy. And as it turned out, my agent negotiated an additional 7 months for me. And I said to her, well, I wrote a really bad book in a year and a half. Imagine what I can do in 7 months. And I started over. You know, I stole a few of the scenes from the Thrown Away book. But there was no Gracie McBride, and
I'm curious. What about why it was so bad? I mean, what was it? Was it just too? You did it too fast, or?
No, obviously I didn't do it too fast.
Well, yeah, I mean,
the book that matters.
Well, you mean you
half
could
the time.
You could. Well, I'm sure it's possible to have to write for 18 months and still write fast. Maybe you don't. You know, maybe you don't work the whole 18 months. But I mean, what? I'm just curious why? How you knew it was so bad?
I think I got too caught up in plot, and I didn't just.
Did you know that while you were writing it?
No. Well, I must have known it somewhere, but I ignored it. And
see, writers should never feel like they have to rush through things. I mean, to me, I mean, if you don't write, if you're going to rush through a book, or well, obviously you didn't rush through it, but it sounds like you felt like you were rushed.
I don't know if I felt like I was rushed so much as I felt like I had to do things.
Well, ideally, how much time would you like to write a book?
Oh, you know, 50 years.
50 years?
No, you know, it would be nice to have, if I wouldn't think of it as amount of time over months or whatever. I would love to be able to just write and not think about other things in the morning. Because I wouldn't write past noon anyway.
No.
But I, you know, so I get in an hour and a half or 2 hours on a good morning, and 500 to 1,000 words. But, you know, there's a certain discipline in stopping and telling stories and letting the characters behave. And it sounds paradoxical, but some days I sit down and I think I'm going to get these two things done, and I put a certain character on the page, and the character says, nah, I've been thinking, you know, my brain's been working on this the last 24 hours when I was off paying the bills, and this is where things are going to go.
Now, I'm very curious about Gus's mother. Now, she's a very interesting character because I kind of think maybe she has Alzheimer's or something similar.
She is in some of the early stages of dementia in the hanging tree.
You don't see that very often in history.
Well, she's 66, so you can see it.
She's a pretty major character in the books. I mean, she's around a lot in the books.
Yeah, and she's very important in Gus's life and plays, although she's not on stage all the time, she plays a very important role in both books, as you'll see. And I think in the third book, to some degree, I think, you know, I haven't written a trilogy. I just wrote one book, and then they told me to write two more. But in the end, the story arc is really about Gus and his mother and their relationship.
So we're going to see more of his mother
and father since he was, you know, a small boy.
Does she have more of a role in book three?
She has a pretty big role thus far, yes.
But even you're not sure where it's going.
I'm not done yet. You know, I never know what the story is until I finish the first draft. And it, in its way, it's a lot like reporting because, you know, nonfiction. Because when I do a story as a reporter, you know, you kind of pile up this mound of clay, interviews and documents and observation, etc., and then you strip away what's not necessary, and what's left is the story. And for me, writing fiction, you know, I do some research, but not a great deal. The reporting is the sitting down every morning and finding out what happened. And then I get a first draft, and I pretty much know what happened, but there are things I don't understand, and so I have to go back and make Gus fix them so that I understand them. Of course, I'm doing that, but...
Well, The Hanging Tree has a huge surprise at the end, and if anybody out there can figure it out, you know, good luck. It's a pretty big surprise, and of course we can't talk about it, but it does have a shocker ending. Even more shocking than Chevy Stevens' book. Wow, what a shocker ending that one had, too.
Really? I haven't read that one.
It's major talent. Oh, yeah, definitely. But, you know, who doesn't love the shocker endings, you know? Am I going to be shocked by the Starvation Lake ending?
I wouldn't say shocked.
But there will be a surprise.
Yes.
You like the surprise.
Well, you know, there are things people hold back from each other, and that's, you know,
That's Soupy's
character. The Starvation Lake isn't so much in the... Yeah, I think it's less about the various surprises.
You have a lot of damaged characters in your books.
Well, you know, I don't know if they're damaged. I think a lot of them are just people. You know, they're flawed.
They're people, but they seem damaged to me.
Flawed.
Yeah, Soupy's definitely flawed.
Well, Soupy is damaged, and you're going to learn a lot more about Soupy. I mean, Soupy's a much more...
You know who I really like?
That character in Starvation.
I really like Joanne, the reporter. She's really got some...
You mean Joni?
Joni.
Oh, she's in Starvation Lake. She's not in the Hanging Tree.
Oh, she's... Oh, that's right. I guess she wasn't.
You're far along. You know, Joni's in there pretty quickly.
Yeah, Joni's...
And she's going to reappear in book three.
She's terrific. I mean, she's too good of a character not to bring back. She's got a lot of nerve, and she's extremely... she just says what she feels.
Yeah. She's named for and inspired by my wife's late aunt, Joan McCarthy.
And if she ever gets mad, you should duck.
Sorry.
Definitely duck. Oh, she's... Wait a minute. You said she's named after who?
It's my wife's late aunt, Joan McCarthy.
Is she just like her?
She's similar. Joan wasn't a journalist, but
Oops.
She spoke her mind.
Are we going to get her in trouble now?
And she didn't like profanity.
Or you in trouble, I should say.
No. Joan's gone to her.
Do some of your friends do that? Do they come up to you and say, now, who am I in one of your books?
You know, I don't really model characters, many of them, on certain people, but I'm sure certain people see traits in there. I've had friends say, I want to be in your book. Well, in fact, I have a buddy I skate with here in Chicago, Johnny Ford. And he's like, Gruhls, I want to be in that book. You got to put my name in the book. So he's in The Hanging Tree, and he's the kid with the... It's not really Johnny, but I used his name. I like that name, Johnny Ford, and he's the kid who gets his...
Wait a minute, So all people have to do is ask to be in your book so they can get in your book?
They want to be in there. Well, you know, I say be careful what you ask for. Somebody in East Jordan, a little town in northern Michigan, I was doing an event there a few weeks ago, said, would you put our town in your next book? And I said, would you like it to be the home of the pedophile or the serial killer?
Oh, my goodness.
And which brought a big laugh, you know. Because it's not like... My sister Kathleen is always telling me, I want to be in the book, I want to be in the book, I want to be in the book. And what woman would you like? Would you like to be Tilly Spaulding in Starvation Lake? Who would want to be her, you know?
Yeah, she's not...
Damaged goods. Yeah, a lot of damaged... You're right. There are a lot of flawed or damaged people.
Well, you'd have to. They'd be pretty boring if they weren't.
Well, if you want, you know, sweet and beautiful, who wants that kind of character in the book? You know?
I'm wondering... Now, there's different sites that people can go on. There's a Starvation Lake site, and you can actually see the town. And
yeah,
here, is that you reading from the books?
Yes, yeah, I'm reading excerpts. Yeah, on starvationlake.com, you can go and visit various places in town, Audrey's Diner and Main Street and The Pilot, which is the paper.
Does it actually show? I haven't gotten through the whole website, but does it actually show what they look like?
Well, not really, because these places don't really exist.
Oh, no, really?
But you see images of what the landscape's like. In fact, there's some pictures.
They exist in your mind.
Yeah, and there are...
And certainly your readers' minds.
From the part of northern lower Michigan that inspired this, that is essentially where it's set. In fact, there is, like you said earlier, David, there is a real Starvation Lake not far from my dad's cottage up north, and I've been to that lake a million times. There's no town on the lake, and it's quite a bit smaller than the lake in my books. But I love that name, and so I stole it.
It's a great name. I mean, it's just it's one of those titles you look at and you think, wow, I have to read that book.
Good.
You really do. I really feel that there's a strong pull because of it. I mean, what does that mean, Starvation Lake? What's he trying to say? The actual name of the lake, or there's some kind of a thing about starving there?
I never thought of it as a metaphor or anything like that. It was just... It's a cool name.
And also the Hanging Tree, you know, it could mean a couple of different things. I mean, they're ambiguous titles. As Jeffrey Deaver likes to say, he likes to have three definitions for his titles. So every one of his titles has at least three meanings.
Really?
Think about it. That's very interesting.
I never thought of it that way. You know, I think meanings just sort of... But I tell reporters, the most important thing for you can do on a story is find out what really happened. And if you find out what really happened, the why and the how will drift to the surface.
Well, without giving any details away, why are you having so much trouble with book three? I mean, what is it? Are these books that difficult to write?
Well, yeah, because they're complicated. a complex plot.
Well, in your mind, are they still complicated in your mind? I mean, you know about where it's going, don't you?
I usually know.
I mean, you say you know.
I knew at the hanging tree. I knew that it starts with a woman hanging in a tree filled with shoes, and that she started that shoe tree years before. And I knew about a few of her relationships to the narrator and other people in town. And I had a vague idea of how it would end, and I didn't know the rest. So when I started, I had no idea that a character like Yarick Vind plays a pretty significant role. I didn't have a note or anything. Did not know this guy existed until I was about a third of the way through the book. And I just keep going and thinking that if I do the work and I think and I take notes to myself as I go, that, you know, the Lord will provide and I'll get it done. And then, you know, what's great is you turn it in and your editor says A, B, C, and D. You need to work on these things. And you can go back and fix it, change it.
Which is great.
Yeah, I love revision.
It's not like live TV where you do what you have. It just goes through, and if it's bad, it's bad. You know, you can actually change things. And these books, which another great thing is they're paperback, and they're only $15. And you know, people are eager. I mean, people don't mind spending paperback. Money's for paperback, whereas hardcover, it's a lot harder to sell a hardcover nowadays.
Yeah, as I understand it is. And of course, even easier to sell is ebooks.
Yeah, these are both on ebook too?
Yeah.
That's terrific.
And Starvation Lake is an audio, and Hanging Tree will be an audio in a couple of months or so.
What did you envision being published would be like, and how is it anything like you envisioned it?
I didn't know what to think, you know?
So the goal was just to get published. That was what you wanted.
Yeah, well, at first I just wanted to see if I could write a novel. And, of course, you wouldn't just write it to just put it in a drawer. You think, well, your goal is to get somebody to say, yes, this is a novel. So having accomplished that, then you start to think, well, might as well have as many people as possible read it, and you do what you can to make that happen. It's really hard. There's so many claims on people's attention. And so I have a friend who works for the journal, Jeff Trachtenberg, who covers the publishing industry, and he gave me a great deal of good advice ahead of the publication of Starvation Lake. We were sitting at the journal one day, and I said to Jeff, you know, what should I expect in terms of sales? And Jeff said, Brian, forget about that. Just go out there and have a great effing time, and the rest of it will take care of itself. And it's great advice, and I have to remind myself of it, that I'm beginning to make things up, tell my stories, and people are actually reading them and sending me nice notes or telling me nice things about them for the most part. And I go around and I make new friends, and I've come across old friends I hadn't seen in 30 or 35 years because of these books.
And you're barely 35 yourself.
I'm 52.
Oh, my. You don't look very old in the back of the book.
Oh, thank you.
You look very young.
Yeah, well, the wonders of Photoshop.
But, I mean, that was now we can say that the title of the third one is going to be Skeleton Box right now, which is... Which is another great title. It sounds like you have an easy time making up the title. It sounds to me like writing the book's the hard parts for you.
What? Three words is easier than 100,000. You are correct, sir. I'm joking.
But a lot of people...
But you know what's telling, David? Remember the book a few minutes ago I said I threw away a book?
Yeah.
I didn't have a title. I had no title for that book. I turned it in without a title.
Yeah, are you supposed to turn it in without a title?
Well, I don't know what you're supposed to do, but I turned the first one in with the title, and the second one I knew was The Hanging Tree right from the start. Right from the very start. When the line...
Well, that's such
hanging in a shoe tree.
Right, it's just a great title. I mean, and then as John LaSqua told me, I don't know if you know John LaSqua.
I know the name.
He said that what he does is he'll tell the publisher, this is going to be my title, and they'll tell him whether they can sell it or not.
Really?
And that's very interesting when you think about it. It's like, certain titles don't sell, and certain titles will sell?
I'm sure that's to a degree true. I mean, just being at the journal and reading or editing and writing a few stories about, you know, product names. You know, there's a whole industry cottage industry of people who figure out what to name the next brand of toothpaste.
Well, look at that Guernsey book. What's it called? The Literary Guernsey and Potato Peel Society. I mean, who would ever think a title like that would sell?
Well, it appeals to a certain audience, and then that audience grows if it's good.
I know that the percentage of how many books are published that are successful is not, I forget what the percentage is, very shocking. But, I mean, what kind of a book is going to sell? I mean, right nowadays, vampires are huge. I mean, any kind of a vampire book you write is going to sell pretty well. But, you know, who has the answer to all these?
Nobody.
Somebody out there must know that the books that will sell.
Well, they know that James Patterson will sell now.
No. But nothing, I mean, some of his books are good and some are crap.
All sell.
What does that say about us as a society?
Well, I don't know. Anybody who sits down and writes and does this, more power to them. And some great books sell and some don't, and some crummy books sell and some don't.
Well,
it's the way it is.
With James Patterson, I take each book separately. It's either going to be good or it isn't, and that's how I feel, and that's how any reader feels. They either like it or they don't like it.
Right.
I mean, Dennis Lehane's worst nightmare, as he told me, he says, I don't mind if people love it or hate it. I hate when they're apathetic to it, when they don't care one way or the other.
Right.
That's what he was. Very interesting comment when you think about it. I mean, not everybody's going to care about your book.
Right. I think the most disconcerting comments I read about the first book were, I just couldn't care about these characters, and I stopped. And there are people like that, and it hurt me, even though I know they weren't personal.
Well, when you were writing them, you cared about them.
Oh, yeah, but these are people, these are readers, and I didn't make those readers care. Well, you can't make everybody...
No.
You can't be everything to everybody. That's just the way it goes. But it still hurt to read those comments.
Do you take that comment and try to improve when you write?
Well, I'm always trying to improve, but if somebody says, I just don't care about those characters, and I invested them with everything I could to make them care, then it's just one of those things, I made them a terrific chocolate sundae, and they don't like chocolate sundaes. So there's nothing I can do about it. I did my best already.
Well, I certainly care about the characters. I certainly care about Gus, and I certainly care about Darlene. Is that her name, Darlene?
Darlene, yeah.
Darlene. I keep thinking I have the wrong name. I don't know why. Even though Darlene gives him a hard time, a lot of people give him a hard time. I still care about all these characters. I care
kind of what you do
about their future. I even care about Gracie, and poor Gracie's dead,
Yeah. Well, that was the trick to that book, is making...
But, the great thing is you could actually write a whole book about Gracie that came before.
I probably could, but I've already limbed the best parts.
That's true, you really have.
The most interesting parts of her life.
That's true. But, it could be done, but, you're right. A lot of it has already been told in The Hanging Tree, but she is a very memorable character. I remember when I interviewed Lisa Scatolini, she wrote a character in her first book, a gay guy, that was absolutely hysterical.
Yeah.
But he dies in the first book.
So.
And I said to her, you got to bring that character back. She keeps threatening to do it, but she never has. And I don't think she ever will. I think she's just trying to put me off.
His death was in a dream.
But there are certain characters that you read that you're always going to love. I mean, James Patterson has his grandmother Alex Cross's grandmother is 97 years old, however old she is, and nothing could ever happen to her because people would be devastated.
Yeah.
She's a major character. Same with the grandma in Janet Ivanovich's series. I mean, once you create these characters that are memorable, you can't kill them.
Well, Updike used to say he couldn't kill his characters because he loved them too much.
Except if your name's Karen Slaughter, who she killed one of her major characters, and it left such a hole in the stories that I don't know if she's ever going to be able to fill. But knowing her, as good as she is, she may just do it.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's always that, Patricia Cornwell, when she killed off Benton Wesley, there was a major outcry about that. Do you feel the same way? Do you feel like there's characters you could never let go of?
Well, probably not Gus.
Yeah, no, I don't think Gus can go.
And I think it would be easy to find a way to kill Soupy because he's so self-destructive, but...
You got a lot of bars in this town too, so anybody could drunk drive and get killed, you know?
Yeah, that would be a big hole to fill. I haven't had to cross that bridge. You know, B has dementia, and that kills you eventually, but we'll see.
Well, I wonder does everybody die from dementia? Or are there people that linger for years and years and
there
years?
There are people that normally they linger for years and years. But unless they make a mistake, you know.
That's very sad.
They're cooking eggs and they forget the eggs are cooking and the house burns down. Or they make a wrong turn on a road and they end up somewhere they don't know where they are. They're disoriented and they get in an accident. You know, that happens, but it's rare.
I think you should put the Starvation Like website up on YouTube. I think you'd get a lot of people looking at that. It's wonderful.
They're able to be up there, but it's tough to get. It's just tough to get through the clutter, David.
Yeah.
There's so much stuff out there.
There is a lot of stuff, but you've got something special.
The people who design my websites, the youngsters, they've done everything they can to get attention to them.
Right. And it grows. I mean, you're not gonna be a major best-selling author unless you get really, 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 really lucky.
Yeah.
And come along. I think you told me you had 26 rejections.
Yes, of the first book.
Well, I think Steve Berry had 83. So something ridiculous like that. So, and he's a major author.
Yeah. I mean, I know there's a matter of luck there, and I also know that you can have a pretty good career if you keep at it and write a lot of books.
Do you think the third book will be out next year, for sure?
Yeah. Well, that's my plan.
Are we keeping you from it right now?
No, I don't write in the evening. I write in the mornings.
That's interesting. My deadline
isn't until April, but I'm hoping to finish it by January so it would come out next year.
I can hardly wait.
Thank you.
I was going to say, why only the morning? Are you more creative in the morning?
It's just the way it is. I like it. I like getting up early and writing, and it's quiet.
How early are we talking? 6, 5 in the morning?
It depends. It varies. I don't like have a set time every day. It depends on what I did the night before.
Do you sit and drink coffee, or do you drink?
Today I got up at like 5:48 or something, and
you must get good ideas in the morning. I always wake up with good ideas in the morning.
But you also have that oh no, I have to write thing, you know.
But it should never
procrastinate for a while. You know, I'd look at the papers.
Does it feel that way every day?
Yeah, most days, yeah. I'm never like, oh, I can't wait to write, because I know I am gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I get up, and then once I get going, then, you know, I have fun.
And
I try to leave myself in a spot where I know what's next. And then, so I have somewhere to start the next day. Hemingway used to, he knew what the next sentence was going to be, and then he would stop. So we had that sentence to start the next day, get him started, you know, a little primer.
That's interesting. So he would go to bed knowing the next sentence and wake up and write the sentence and then continue from there. I wonder how much he wrote during a day.
On a good day, 200 good words.
That's all he wrote?
Yeah.
That doesn't seem like much, does it?
No, but, you know, he had it made.
He certainly did. What he wrote will be read for ages and ages and ages.
Forever. Just, you know. And you know, one of my favorites, the Nick Adams stories are just phenomenal. And, you know, a lot of the places in the Nick, some of the places in the Nick Adams stories I'm familiar with because it's Northern Michigan. And a few of them are mentioned in my books as well.
What do you do when you're not writing? I mean, do you have hobbies? Do you go out and do you vacation?
Yeah, I play hockey.
You do actually still play hockey?
Oh, yeah, yeah. During the winter, 2 or 3 times a week, and in the summer, once a week or so. My wife and I like to cook and go to good restaurants.
Now, do you have sons to play hockey with?
I have a son, but he doesn't play hockey. And we have daughters, and they don't play hockey. But
does that bother you?
No. It would be cool if Joel played hockey, but no, it doesn't bother me at all.
I have a brother who's a fanatical hockey fan. I mean, really, really over the top.
You're a Flyers fan?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Big time.
Yeah.
Big time. He's been through... But he knows a lot about hockey.
Yeah. Well, you should give him my books.
Absolutely. Thing is, he doesn't read mysteries. I don't know.
And I like music, you know. I play guitar. You know, I know like 5 chords, but that's enough to play a lot of songs. And I love going up to Northern Michigan. I mean, for all the darkness and, and flawed characters I portray in these books, I've never met anybody nearly as bad as the bad guys in my books up north. It's just my favorite place in the whole world. So I like to go up there once in a while. And we have daughters in D.C., so we go up there, and we have a son in Wisconsin, and we'll be visiting him there. And
can you see yourself writing 10 books in this series, if they let you?
I think I could come up with it, yeah.
And would it be hard, would it get harder with each book to come up with a scenario of something happening in the town? I mean, how many things can happen in the town, you know?
To some degree, you gotta get cut a break on that. You know, people can't say, well, I wanted you to write more about Gus, and then say, well, it's incredible that all these things would happen at Starvation Lake. Well, of course it is.
Well, how many people are in
there? I'm not going to write about Gus anymore. Well, you know, so...
In your mind, and that's another question I should have asked you. In your mind, how many people are in this town?
I don't know.
Would you say, are we talking thousands?
Yeah, a couple thousand maybe.
So the more people
in the county. I'd say in the county.
Well, it's interesting because Craig, I don't know if you've heard of Craig Johnson. He's a very, very good...
Yeah, the guy from Wyoming.
Yeah. He lives in a town of 23 people. So it's like,
wow.
Which, you know, you can't have a town in a book with 23 people. I mean, how many things can happen to 23 different people?
So but you know, that's okay. You have to have some suspension of disbelief here. Otherwise, it's just going to be one book. That's it.
Well, you had 12 years of, Murder, She Wrote.
That's right. See?
And everywhere she went, somebody got killed. The question is, why did anybody want to hang around with her? You know?
Right.
You could end up dead.
Right.
But, so you never worry about that. You just
continue. Well, I haven't worried about it. And, you know, you haven't finished the first book, so there's that thing that happened. And the second book is, it's much more, these aren't like classic murder mysteries where there's, you know, a body is found out in the middle of the street, and it's spectacular. There are more natural things that happen. A woman's found hanging in a tree. We all knew Gracie McBride. This is what Gus even says. She was racing to the gates of hell her whole life. She just got there a little early.
And that's another great thing you do with your books. I mean, you read Hanging Tree, and you really feel like you know Gracie by the end of the book. You really feel like you know everything about her, which is, I mean... She becomes this three-dimensional character, whereas in the beginning she's just a dead body.
I appreciate that. That means a great deal to me to hear that, because that was the greatest challenge of that book, is to make people care about Gracie, because she's not an easy person to care about.
No, and she
doesn't care about herself.
She's not the smartest, whatever you want to call her, in the book. But you do, by the end of this book, you care about her very much.
I'm glad.
And... Well, anyway, we have run out of time. I wish we had all night to talk, but these books are just terrific. I hope everybody reads them, Starvation Lake, and, of course, The Hanging Tree, both out from Touchstone, both in paperback, and both available at your bookstores, your e-books, everything. It's been great, Brian. Thank you so much.
Thanks for all the great questions, David.
You're welcome. This has been David's Book Talk. We will talk to you next time.